Thank you, Mr. Nemitz. Good afternoon, everyone. I want to say thank you for the setup because this is a little unusual for me. I have not given a PowerPoint presentation in some time, but I do appreciate all the work that was put into getting this ready. And pleasure to be with you today. I always consider it a privilege to be here, and particularly today, driving up in the sunshine. What a change from last week's weather. I heard it was a little chilly here last week. Just a little bit. Well, they're compensating with the warmth today, so welcome. And with that, clearly the topic I will be presenting today is concerning what is the story of evolution. And I hope that our technology will be working nicely today. By coincidence or not, walking through the hallway of my own high school where I teach in the suburbs of Chicago, I ran across this, and it jolted me and stopped me because our students, at least in my school of 2,600, are being told you are the product of 3.8 billion years of evolutionary success. These were the exact words. Act like it. And that took me aback because I thought, well, this is not a science notice. It's just a premise which unfortunately is much like a stranglehold in education. And we well know this, don't we? And that stranglehold is only getting a little tighter as the years go by. Because after all, this is the stronghold of the atheist. This is their fallback position, which they must have in order to maintain an atheistic philosophy. Now, I spoke to various church members and got a variety of responses on whether this would be a good topic. And some who I admire said, no, you're preaching to the choir with this kind of topic. But others, notably younger members of our congregation, said, well, we'd like to hear something on how to refute this premise, this idea of evolution. So with that, I think the basis behind giving this message today is, well, and actually, I had forgotten that I had left this blank for a particular reason, because this is what the Bible has to say about evolution. It is utterly silent, and with good reason, because there is absolutely nothing in the biblical narrative that in any way presupposes that there's evolution taking place. And I just found that thought that would be appropriate to put it up with a blank screen. And for those listening in, that's what we have up on the screen right now. But our premise starts with that we as Christians are told in 1 Peter 3:15, sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks, a reason for the hope that is in you with both meekness and with fear. And just curious, how many in the group today have actually had a conversation about atheism versus creationism or against evolution? A few have. I think over time there will be individuals that we come across who generally would like to know. In fact, I spoke with the librarian and just briefly mentioned why I needed to get some technological information. And she was asking, well, what's this for? And I said, well, I'm giving a message about how evolution is wrong. And she was kind of taken aback by that. So I went on to explain a few points that I'll be giving to you today. How do we attack, or how do we refute evolution? There are so many aspects to it. You have the beginning of life. You have the stunning diversity of all the living creatures on Earth, let alone the very origins of our universe. But the basic is the Genesis account. And we'll be coming back to that a little later, in which God said he made it and made it very good. Now, I'll be reviewing and addressing the basic doctrine of evolutionary theory, put forward by Charles Darwin, I believe it was the year 1853, in his famous treatise on Origin of Species, and the claim that it explains all of life with its amazing variety. And it's interesting to note that the man who began this modern, or was used to begin this modern era of God's church, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, was also challenged during a period of economic downturn, and he had to spend 6 months' time studying two things. First was being confronted with the Sabbath day. But secondly, was the notion of evolution. And Mr. Armstrong determined that it was merely a story, a narrative, not an explanation. So to begin, I respect the fact that you and I, as people of faith, for whom the simple arguments, creation requires a creator, design requires a designer, this is secondhand to us, or second nature rather. But hopefully this will serve as something of a refresher and at the same time increase the awe that we should have of the grandeur and the majesty of what God has made when he gave life. Now, it can be difficult to counter this mindset of atheism, you know, as the hallway notice illustrates. And because in academia, it's considered just unscientific to not believe in evolution. And I'll bring up several quotations from both staunch evolutionists as well as creationists. And let's see if I get my next one. There we go. Quotation says, "Allegiance to Darwinism has become the litmus. It is the major test for deciding who does and who does not hold, quote, a properly scientific worldview." And this is from a book called What Darwin Got Wrong. Interestingly, these men are evolutionists. They are not creationists. They are not believers in creation. They are really atheists. But nevertheless, they said his theory has flaws. Now here's the lie, and I don't have a slide for this, but in the introduction of this book called What Darwin Got Wrong, we have been told, these are the two authors, Fodor and Pietelli, Palmerini, they said, "We have been told by more than one of our colleagues that even if Darwin was substantially wrong when he claimed natural selection is the mechanism for evolution, nonetheless we shouldn't say so. Not anyhow in public." This is in the introduction of the book. "Not in public. To do that is inadvertently to align oneself with the forces of darkness." These are their exact words. "Whose goal is to bring science into disrepute." That's us. And yet, it's interesting that they should be so forthright to say, well, don't speak about this in public. But what is science, after all? Dr. Linus Pauling, the only man ever to win the Nobel Prize two times for chemistry, wrote this. He said, "Science is the search for truth, the effort to understand the world." And yet, we have the tools through science. We have the tools to observe, to reason, and that is the heart and core of scientific theory. And I'll bring out later how there's nothing unscientific about creationism, even though the Bible does not pretend to be a science textbook. It doesn't say it's a science textbook. Nevertheless, everything it says is scientifically accurate. But is scientific inquiry untainted from human nature? No, unfortunately, human nature gets the way. So another quotation. And this from a man you may have heard of, Richard Dawkins. I consider him the high priest of evolution. You may have heard his name. He's written The God Delusion. He's written The Selfish Gene. And he said this: "It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that." This is a very intelligent individual. When you hear him speak, you know he is a man of letters, he is very learned, he is very schooled, yet he is dyed in the wool. He is absolutely a believer in evolution as the all-explaining philosophy. So let's begin. I want to state at the outset, I believe in evolution. I am an evolutionist. I am a literal card-carrying, dyed-in-the-wool evolutionist. Now, I say that as your standard grabbing attention statement, because here's the evolution I believe in. I don't know the number of variety of breeds of dog with all their tremendous different traits, but they're all dogs. So, in saying that I believe in evolution, I'm not saying anything unusual at all. But now the question is, which evolution do I believe in? Which evolution am I talking about? Well, this is each after its own kind, and I'm going to bring up a show that you may have heard of called The View, with a lady named Joy Behar. Well, she had a guest on, a rather impressive man, who is named Dinesh D'Souza. And they got to talking about evolution. She said, "Now, you don't believe in evolution." And he says, "Well, we have to talk about microevolution and macroevolution." She says, "Oh, we don't want to go there. We don't want to get down into the weeds." But we do want to get down into the weeds, because microevolution means changes within a species. It's very simple. Dogs can go all the way from a Chihuahua to a Great Dane, but they're still absolutely dogs. Now, throughout the message, I'd like to give you questions that you could use And that's why I called it questioning the evolutionary story. Where is life being created today from non-life? This is another question that we're going to delve into. But the first one, not to go over too quickly, is which evolution are you talking about? Are you talking about change within a species? That's called micro. Or are you talking about a dog becoming a cat? Which we don't see. We don't see cogs and dats. They just don't exist. So our next question, where is life being created today? Make sure I have my place. All right, so I looked for an image and I didn't find one of a dog actually changing into a cat. So I'm sorry I couldn't put that up on the screen. But you could take it across a wide variety of species. We don't see a mouse changing into a mole. We don't see a cockroach changing into a ladybug. They simply don't change in that way. So what does the Bible expressly and directly say about evolution? As I said, nothing. However, and I did not put it on the screen, so this is, if you wish to turn to it, it's Genesis 1, verses 20 to 25. And this is foundational with this whole topic of the evolutionary story. So Genesis 1, 20 up to 25. And this is basic, we've heard it multiple times. God said, "Let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures. Let the birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens." So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded, according to their kind. And I don't believe this is new for most of us here, but it's always according to their kind. Every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw it was good, and God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the waters and the seas, let birds multiply on the earth." Verse 24, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing, beast of the earth, each according to its kind." So notice the repetition. This means it's especially important. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. In other words, he was setting the range and the bounds of species. And we'll come back to that in a little bit more in just a moment. Everything that creeps on the earth, and God saw that it was very good. So notice, the limits cannot be violated, only according to its kind. So with that, one of the foundational scriptures that you may wish to turn to as well in the book of Romans. And if we do talk about evolution, this one must come up. In the book of Romans, in the first chapter, in verses 20 and 21, does speak to those who do not look at the creation and rightly interpret what they see. Romans 1, verses 20 and 21. For, it means because, since the creation of the world, his, our great creator, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen. Paul tells us, look around you, use your eyes, we can see God, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they, mean the non-believers, are without excuse. They have no excuse. Verse 21, because although they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile. And futile means worthless. Worthless in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. And I think this relates to the message I gave some months back concerning a veil that's over men's hearts. And sometimes it's willingly placed there. And we'll come back to that near the end of the message. So where should we begin with answering this story, questioning the evolutionary story? Well, let's begin at the beginning with the universe, the whole universe. So the universe and the story of science is in perfect accord with the biblical account. Everyone has heard of the Big Bang. Cosmologists, and that's those who study the universe, have talked about their starting at a zero point where there was no matter, there was no space, there was no time. And years ago, I read a book called In the Beginning, and the very, very opening chapter talked about this Big Bang. And the Big Bang, as they understand it, was that everything that exists in the entirety of the universe could be fit in the period at the end of a sentence. Then it exploded. And in one quadrillionth of a second, it expanded to the size of a galaxy. That kind of sounds like the biblical account to me. I think that pretty much encapsulates the biblical account. But we go on. After the universe was created, Then it was fine-tuned. There were laws that were delicately balanced, including the law of gravity, including the rate of expansion. And I remember reading a book called The Intellectual Speak Out About God, and it talked about background radiation. So at this moment, there is background radiation that is surrounding us. We never think about it, and I don't fully understand it, but scientists say that there is a background radiation. If it were 1% greater, we could not exist. If it were 1% smaller, we could not exist. This is called fine-tuning. It seems like the universe was made for man. So, Sir Fred Hoyle, and I'll give a quotation from him twice. I actually went ahead a little faster than I should have, but the first quotation is that this man, Sir Fred Hoyle, who is a noted mathematician, said, "It looks as if a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests a super intellect monkeyed with physics and chemistry to make life possible." And then we go on to the likelihood of the formation of life from inanimate, that means dead matter, is 1 to a number with 40,000 knots, 40,000 zeros, the number after that is not correct, but 40,000 zeros after the number 10. It is big enough to bury Darwin and the whole theory of evolution. There wasn't any primeval soup, neither on this planet nor any other. And if the beginnings of life were not random, they therefore must have been the product of purposeful intelligence. And this is from a man who studies mathematics, so he knows whereof he speaks. So, I believe at this point, I hope the next slide says it. Oh, one more quotation from Mr. Hoyle. "The chance that that higher life forms might have emerged through evolutionary processes is comparable with the chance a tornado swept through a junkyard and assembled a Boeing 747 from the material therein." So, yeah, not really credible. And I would say that Mr. Hoyle left out two other factors. If a Boeing 747 actually materialized, there'd have to be a female 747, because then you couldn't make more of them. So you would always have to have two. So it's doubly unlikely that that would take place. All right. So, and I hope my are in order. Now, I seem to have missed one, and forgive me, I may be a little bit out of order with this. So I want to mention that one of the questions, which does not seem to be in the same order I had expected, is you could ask this question: when have you seen life appearing from non-life? So a person who believes in evolution, just say, well, when in your experience did you see life simply appearing, just growing up out of the rocks or out of something that's dead? And that should leave them scratching their heads, because you can't find it, even in the laboratories. So a biologist by the name of Michael Behe wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. He says, what is evolution? It means that there's a process whereby life came from non-matter, non-life. Is this credible? But science says, well, it had to happen, because we're here after all. So that's proof. Because we're here, it must have come from non-life. And we can see how badly that is reasoned. So next I'd like to mention that currently in textbooks around the nation, at high school level, at college level, there are certain experiments and there are certain statements that are just a given. They're kind of the foundation of biological science. And I have referred many times over the past decade to a book by one of those gentlemen who does not find evolution works. And his name is Jonathan Wells. He wrote this book called Icons of Evolution. And he called it icons because an icon is something that you don't think about it very much. It just has this picture, which is why I had at the beginning the picture of the men growing up from the chimpanzee up to a full human being. Oh, that looks very, very logical, doesn't it? In fact, the city that I grew up in had a natural history museum. And when you walked in the door, the whole wall was covered with this diorama of the chimpanzee becoming a human being. And so you just took it as natural. Well, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. But one of the icons concerns an experiment done at the University of Chicago, basically just up the road, you could say, back in 1953. And they were called the Urey-Miller experiments. Harold Urey and Stan Miller did an experiment in which they tried to replicate what was the Earth like when life might have evolved. What was that primordial soup that was on the Earth? So, very simple experiment. I won't go into full details, but they set up what should have been the atmosphere on the Earth inside a flask. and it contained ammonia, it contained methane, it contained hydrogen. And then they heated it and they shot electrical bolts through it for a period of a couple of weeks. Oh, guess what? Simple amino acids appeared. So the molecules joined together and produced simple, what are called organic compounds. Now, take into account, this was in a laboratory, so it was created by living beings. They created organic matter. But what was really interesting about this is the National Geographic ran a special on this experiment, which was called the Urey Miller experiments. Remember, at the University of Chicago in 1953, and with these experiments, National Geographic had Stan Miller standing beside his apparatus and saying, well, yes, after we put the electricity through it, amino acids appeared, and after that, it's easy. That was the statement in National Geographic. After that, it's easy. Well, here's the kicker. The kicker is simply this, that the atmosphere that they put into this flask was categorically, absolutely not the atmosphere that was in the actual Earth's atmosphere billions of years ago. Other scientists have come along, and for reasons I won't go into, have said, no, you got it wrong. The whole experiment should be thrown out. The sad thing is that experiment results are still in high school and college textbooks. In other words, the lie is left as a statement of fact in biology textbooks throughout education. And it's not refuted at all, except for a small number of people such as Jonathan Wells, who understands it and is able to properly refute the situation. So, can we get life from life? No, that's not possible. So with this, we get to go on to the kinds of premises or foundations that that evolution has. So here's one of the premises, two of the premises rather. And all of evolution can be said to be based on these two premises. One is random mutations, and the other one is natural selection. So what is random mutations? Well, we've probably seen two-headed calves, and we've seen five-legged goats before. Well, that's a mutation. So the idea is that over enough time, these mutations did take place so that it eventually branched off and became another creature, in other words, another species. But is that really true? In fact, almost always the mutation is inferior. And this man, Jonathan Wells, brings up Drosophila. What's Drosophila? It's the fruit fly. Fruit fly reproduces over a very quick schedule, so in just a couple of days you have another generation. So it turns out that they produced fruit flies that produce an appendage that looks like another set of wings. Only problem is they're weaker and they actually don't function, so they don't even work. So in no way is it actually a positive mutation. And this is the best that they've come up with in the laboratory. So in other words, you may also have the question, and here's one more for you. Have scientists ever observed a beneficial mutation? Have scientists ever observed a beneficial mutation? A man named Dr. Henry Morris III has said, although many experiments have attempted to duplicate some form of evolutionary change, no one has ever come close to evolving anything, even in the laboratory. Another corollary, and I'm going to see if I have my order correct or not. There we go. Okay, we are back on track. And another question, hot on the heels. Do we observe in the natural world, in the natural realm, anywhere where one creature is becoming another creature? So ask an evolutionist, oh, have you been to the zoo lately? Did you see any giraffes becoming hippopotami? To make a little light of it. So, in order for science to demonstrate that there were many, many transition forms, because that's what we're talking about, is moving from one species to another with many, many intermediary species, as it were, or different forms, they would have to demonstrate a progression and an order. But the evidence doesn't support it. So what we go on to is the so-called fossil record. And the fossil record gives no evidence that this has ever occurred. Here's Darwin's own words. Why is there not in every geological formation and every stratum full of these intermediate links, these transition forms into other species? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection that can be urged against the theory. So this is what Darwin said. Here's the objection. We can't find any of those so-called missing links. So how did he account for that? In his book On Origin of Species, he says, the explanation lies, as I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record. All we have to do is keep digging, and if we dig enough, we'll find all of those forms. Now, there's a great irony in the title of his book, Origin of Species, because he never answered the question. In the entire book, that question, what is the origin of species, just doesn't have an answer. So, indeed, the title is false because new species cannot evolve by natural selection. So that was the second pillar, natural selection. There is not one single change of species into another on record. Now, by the way, this is not on the screen, but it's also Charles Darwin's own words. He says, no one has seen a change of species into another anywhere on the record, and so we cannot prove that a single species has been changed. So Charles Darwin himself, a man who is still lionized. In fact, I looked up some pictures of the currency of England. You know, he's actually on the British currency. He's on the pound note. He's on the coins that are used in England because this man is so lionized. Well, let's go on to our next slide, what I call the icon of evolution. It looks so appealing. It looks so logical. It looks so common sense that most people don't think about it, particularly high school students, and I well know that for a fact. They wouldn't question this. But this is a lie. You cannot find all of the steady links up to modern man. So as a result, this man, Jonathan Wells, says, this is one of the icons of evolution. His subtitle is, it science or is it myth? And this is a myth, a sad and unfortunate myth. A diligent search for these so-called transitional form fossils over a period of 150 years since Darwin has failed to disclose any. These years of diligent research indicate that there is a glaring absence of molecule to man. And that's what evolution says. You start with simple molecules and come all the way up to human beings. Now, it's very kind of dense reading, but a fascinating topic. In other words, the empirical data of the Earth's fossils, if it's analyzed, shows that evolutionary phylogeny, sorry about throwing out the scientific words, I know I haven't heard them since high school myself either, but evolutionary phylogeny notions are just empty imaginings and are refuted by the evidence, or rather, the lack of evidence. Creationists press home the point that random processes, remember, random mutation and natural selection accounts for everything, everything. They have said that at work in evolution, they cannot account for the origin of new information required to increase complexity and generate new functions and new organs. Now, because of this failure to find any missing links at all in the fossil record that were required by Darwin's theory, many now reject Darwinism but are suggesting radical new theories concerning the evolutionary approach. Now, I have to mention that part of the reason for this presentation is during my days at Ambassador College, we had one single lecture on evolution, and I really found it actually not very satisfying because at that time, what had come out was the idea of punctualism. And you may not have heard of punctualism, but it's the spontaneous rising up of new forms. In other words, out of nothing, new forms just suddenly appeared. But they gave it a name, so that makes it scientific, right? It's called punctualism. And that was mentioned, but it wasn't clearly refuted. So now, almost all, these are scientists, are chorusing in unison, evolution is still a fact. It still is a fact. Isn't it amazing? After 120 years of studying Darwin, looking for his missing links, that wonderful, marvelous mechanism that he says is responsible for swinging the majority of scientists over to evolution is being discredited, and somehow everyone knows evolution's still a fact. Isn't that sad? It reminded me of Joseph Goebbels, right? The Nazi who said, if you tell a lie often enough, and if it's a big enough lie, people will eventually believe it. On to another major flaw, major problem with this idea of natural selection. Now, the idea of natural selection is actually really simple. It says that individuals in populations vary slightly. Well, we saw that with dogs. Yeah, there's no problem. There's all kinds of varieties of dogs. Some of those variations help the individuals possess them to produce more offspring. So if they're healthier, they produce more babies. Those offspring in turn inherit the successful variation and produce more offspring. As the generations pass, and they'll often say, in fact, I had arguments with the biology teacher in my high school. She says, oh, Will, but you don't understand how many millions and tens of millions of years we're talking about. And we're going to answer that in just a few moments, but oh yes, I do fully understand. So, with a great quotation from a mathematician. So, these populations evolve toward a variation that is more successful, and as these new helpful variations arise, they're selected, and then they're layered on top of each other to replace the previous variation. And in fact, on display at the University of Science and Industry is an exhibit that says exactly that, and it has a whole series of different horses, one of which is called Aohippus. You know, Aohippus was only about yay high, only about that large. But we know there are miniature horses now, still, aren't there? And yet the museum says this is absolute proof of evolution at work. Because the horse today, the Clydesdale, that's so different from this tiny horse that we see in the fossil record. Well, one writer said, you know, it's a little bit like if you took the bones from a Chihuahua and a Schnauzer and a German Shepherd and a Great Dane. Okay, you took all of their bones and you stacked them on top of each other. Right? And then you let the years go by until an archaeologist dug them up. He'd say, well, look, this tiny one, the Chihuahua, and this one, the Great Dane, that's proof of evolution. Well, I hope you understand, it isn't proof. It's just variation within the species. So here's the great flaw. Natural selection can't innovate. It can't produce anything new. In other words, it can't add new information. It just manages to get rid of the weak ones, but it doesn't contribute new traits. It doesn't bring new traits to the species. It doesn't add genetic information. And here's a quotation from this Dr. Miller. Mutations do change the code of the DNA, but most of them are accidents and they're so small the effect is not important. It's not remarkable. And those that do make a change are overwhelmingly negative. They're negative. They die before maturity or they're ignored by the rest of the population. Okay. So, selective breeding. Horses, dogs, yeah, but that's not evolution because it's not random. It's not random at all. The lack of purpose or a focus, nothing has changed from one kind of creature into another kind of creature. So here's the bottom line. Modern science observes no upward movement or upward evolution. And if you see a human being evolving into something new and better, I'd love to meet that person. It's unlikely to find someone like that. So breeding can produce a variety of dogs because they have recessive traits, but natural selection can never extend the DNA limit. And now we get into the heavy science with the four-strand DNA. Now, I am not a scientist, I am a reader, and I will do my best to just summarize it, but the code of DNA consists of four different amino acids set in different orders. And that is what all of life and all of tissue and all of the DNA strands is made up of. But this DNA is part of the most complicated cell in the human body. Now, this is where the awe of our human creator comes in. The average human has about 50 trillion cells in their body. 46 of these molecules, and you understand chromosomes and their strands, as we see here, in every cell of your body and of my body, if they were stretched out and laid end to end, these chromosomes in your body and my body would stretch to the moon and back 550,000 times. But the amount of DNA in our body would only fill about 2 tablespoons. Is that phenomenal? It boggles my mind. The code in the chromosomes is more complex and holds more information than all the computer programs ever written by humankind. Ever. This was on a slide, so I'll bring it up. If you were to type out all the information contained in all the chromosomes of one human being, You'd write enough books to fill the Grand Canyon 78 times. I love those kinds of analogies. It just boggles the mind. Let's go to another one. This is from Mr. Bill Gates. DNA is like a software program, but it's much more complex than anything we human beings can design. So just think about that. A random process that does not have any thinking capability is able to produce something greater than any human being alive has ever been able to create. It doesn't seem to really match up. What are the odds that a single, simple cell organism could evolve given the complexity of more than 100 different configurations all in the correct places? And this is a quotation from the mathematician Fred Hoyle. He says, eternity is not enough time to do it. Eternity would not be enough time. It's statistically impossible. And well, can we say this? There is a smaller number of scriptures in this message, but I think some of them drive home the point. David knew. He said, "You formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you." He didn't have a microscope. He didn't know about DNA, but he understood enough that God was praiseworthy for having created him. "For I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and my soul knows it very well." I'm going to move on to something rather unusual, which I think will be very interesting, but very challenging at the same time. This actually is very similar to what my colleague at my high school uses in her classroom, puts it up on the board. Now, Charles Darwin had no idea of the complexity of the cell. He thought of it as just a kind of a lump of protoplasm. And yet, how amazing the human cell is. A man named Stephen Meyer is one of the great apologists for creation and intelligent design. He said this: "There's an infinite realm of nanotechnology and information processing inside the cell. There are miniature circuits inside the cell. There are miniature machines. And in one particular cell," he says, "there's a rotary engine in the cell wall. Kind of looks like Mazda designed it. There are O-rings, there are bushings, there's a drive shaft and a propeller that moves the bacterium through the liquid." This is inside the cell, of which we have 50 trillion inside our bodies. One writer said that when a baby is forming in the womb, some 15,000 cells are formed per second. 15,000 cells per second are growing. And each of those cells has more complexity than the lunar module that went to the moon and back. 15,000 of them. And now we go to one of the great, I think one of the great arguments against evolution, and it has a difficult, challenging name. It's called irreducible complexity. So let me explain what irreducible complexity is. It's a system that has multiple pieces or parts. And if you take away one of the components, it doesn't work. So with the mousetrap, as you can see, simply six parts, a spring, a catch, a platform, a hold down bar. If you took away any one of those parts, it wouldn't work. So if you reduce it by taking away one and it no longer functions, that is irreducible complexity. Now, to be fair to those who are evolutionists, they say, "Oh, this is a bad example. I can produce a five-part mousetrap. I can produce a four-part mousetrap." In fact, on one website, they had a four-part, three-part, two-part, one-part mousetrap, a mousetrap that functioned with only one part. And that kind of set me back because I thought this was a very good argument. But a couple of points is that this is just an analogy, and we're talking about this particular mousetrap. If you take any one part of this particular mousetrap, it doesn't work. So let's go on to how this irreducible complexity works. And Charles Darwin, I couldn't find the quotation, he said he stood in almost, I don't want to misquote the man, but almost in horror of the human eye, because the human eye has some 300 different processes and they all have to work in order for us to have human vision. All of them. If you take away one of them, the eye doesn't function. And this is called irreducible complexity. And it's throughout nature. You could do it with many organs of the body, but the eye is, I think, just one of the most prominent or interesting. So, with the mousetrap analogy, I think I fairly covered that, but this is called irreducible complexity. And I don't think I put it on a slide, but if it could, this is from Charles Darwin. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ, the eye, the liver, the kidney, the heart, existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. So he said, my theory wouldn't work if you couldn't find a way that there were many, 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 many tiny changes to bring this about. Well, most scientists now are looking at that and going, oh, yeah, we don't have that. Therefore, our understanding of Darwinism isn't working. And I didn't put this down in my notes, but I want to mention that there were videos on YouTube. Really enjoy them. Some men who come out and say, well, I'm an atheist. I don't have any dog in the race. I don't believe in creationism at all. He says, but, and this person was a molecular biologist. He says, this is what I do for a living. I put together molecules. But I take information that is already organic, and then I put it together. I don't create anything new. And he said to the dean of his department at a major university, he said, do you understand this stuff? And he says, I've talked to Nobel Prize winners, scientists of every caliber, and if they don't want to answer, they just hang their head and they don't say anything. But he says, I'm just waiting for someone to explain this evolution thing to me. This is a prominent scientist who doesn't care what people think of him. Unfortunately, he's a little bit on the rare side. So we've studied the eye. And I'd like to go now to my studies through a long time, because as you can tell, this is kind of an interesting topic. It is the major hallmark of atheism. This is what we fight against, and this is the tidal wave that's continuing in our society is creationism. Come on, you're just a hick. You're a hillbilly. You believe in that? Come on. You got to be scientific. So over time, I thought, well, here's a simple one. You're walking along a road, and as you walk along the road, your foot kicks this object. And you pick it up and you go, huh, somebody must have broken a cup. And your friend says, no, that's not part of a cup. That just formed itself on its own. You know, with wind and erosion and water, come on, it just looks like it was designed. And you say, what, are you nuts? This is from a cup. Somebody designed this. All right, so something as simple as that example. And we go on to something a little bit more, and this was a great video called Not the God Delusion, but the Evolution Delusion. The Evolution Delusion said, well, if I could give you one question or one piece of evidence, would you believe in God? You got books in your laps, many of you. What would you say to someone who said, well, that book just formed itself. The ink just came out of the sky, and it just produced itself, all its information itself. Would you have a lot of credence in that person's intelligence? Would you really believe that? No, well, that's the same with the DNA. That's the same with our human bodies. Can you possibly believe that it wouldn't be designed? Question. Is there anywhere in nature that organized pieces of information spontaneously appear? They just, poof, information, organized, and truly from some intelligence, by random unthinking forces. Because after all, evolution doesn't claim to have any mind behind it. It just happens. So this, I think, is a very challenging question for evolutionists or atheists. So in sum, you can say that really, evolutionists, in fact, have a religion. It's a faith. And it differs from, oh, I'm sorry, one more quotation from, oh no, we had that already, pardon me. One more quotation that I think fits in this whole theme is, our faith rests on this statement, Colossians 1:15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him were all things created. There's no mealy-mouthed if, perhaps, or maybes about this. Created by God in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, thrones, dominions, principalities, powers, all things were created by him and through him and for him. And this is the basis of our faith. But the faith of the atheist is in an eternal universe. It's harsh, it's random, it's purposeless, it's malevolent. But we believe on the uncreated, ever-existing one who with benevolence created a finely tuned universe that is fitted precisely for our development and well-being. So why is it that there's this continued attraction to Darwin's claims among the intellectual elite? This comes from a man named William Debski, and William Debski is roundly condemned throughout the academic and the scientific community because he is a firm believer in intelligent design. It's a book called Uncommon Descent. He says, the central claim of evolutionary biology is that some unguided physical force can account for the emergence of all biological complexity and diversity. And I thought it was worth putting on the screen. This is the summation of what he says. What drives the continued appeal of evolution? One, they want to escape from evolution. And two, he calls it the ultimate free lunch. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, the promise is you can get design without a designer. Oh, that's great. That's very, very attractive. It's the ultimate free lunch. And Daniel Dennett, who stands on the other side of the spectrum, says, no, evolution is the single best idea we have ever had in science. You can see the gulf between the two sides. But getting design without any designer, that's a pretty good trick. That's a pretty neat trick. Ironically, the following was written by an evolutionary scientist. He said, the illusion of purpose is so powerful, it's an illusion, but it's so powerful, that biologists themselves start with the assumption of good design and make it their working tool. Isn't that an ironic statement? Quotation from Mr. Dawkins. Mr. Dawkins defines biology as the study of complicated things that only have the appearance of having been designed with a purpose. So the veil that's over his eyes, that we spoke of out of Isaiah several months back, is that he doesn't see. He has the same eyes we have. He looks at the same universe, the same phenomena as we have, and yet he can't see it. Because I would suspect he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to see it. Let's go to the book of Psalms as we near the end of the message. We see the gulf. And this may have jumped to your mind already. Psalm 53:1. The fool said in his heart, there isn't any God. They are corrupt. David, under inspiration of God, says, they're corrupt. They've done iniquity. There's none who does good. And notice how the two are juxtapositioned side by side. Right? They're a fool, no God, and so they do corrupt things. Verse 2, God looks down from heaven on the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. And I alluded to this in a previous message. God is looking for those who understand and desire to follow him. Verse 3, every one of them has turned aside. They've all together become corrupt. None who does good, no, not one. That's a very sad, sad statement. One final one. Also in the book of Psalms, chapter 111. If you're turning to it, Psalm 111, verses 2 to 4. The works of the Lord are great, studied by all those who have pleasure in them. His work is honorable, glorious, his righteousness enduring forever. He has made his wonderful works to be remembered. Everything we see around us, the creation cries out for a designer, a creator. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion. So in ending, as we marvel at the works of the Lord, all the evidence that there is a grand designer, our Father in heaven, who in his kindness and in his wisdom prepared this world for us and gave us life, let us be prepared to answer those whose only faith is in the story of evolution. Be prepared to answer them with the right question.